WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, I think even more basic than that, why did he tape?
Why did he tape, sure.
Which is not hard for me to understand. While I wasn't privy to the fact that he was taping, the fact that he was doesn't surprise me. When I first went to the White House, they had a system of having the staff man who was always present, and there always was a staff man present, in a meeting with somebody with the president, that after the meeting they would go out and prepare a memorandum of the meeting. And specifically to be included in that memorandum were things that the president had said to the outsider by way of decision-making or instructions or direction or something of that nature. And those memoranda were made because they wanted to protect the president. So somebody who came in and met with the president couldn't say the president had told him to do something. Indeed, the president had not. The president had a staff man present who had made a memorandum of that meeting to back him up. But the memorandum system didn't work very well. And soon there was a tremendous backlog. People like Henry Kissinger would say, I've got more important things to do than write memoranda of old meetings. I've got to get planning for new ones. So the system broke down, and Bob Holliman, who had a bent for efficiency, it's not a great leap for me to understand him suggesting to the president, well, let's put a taping machine in, then we'll have it all. Mm-hmm. Then we don't have to worry about the memos.
It seems that there was quite a likelihood when you were taking the stand in the hearings that the tapes would be used to see if they could get you on one of the points, even a moot point, like, no, it was a different day, or no, it was a different quote.
Terry, that brings us exactly to the next phase of the question you originally asked, and that is, why didn't he destroy the tapes? Well, I've read all of the 64 subpoenaed tapes, and in the tapes, most of which have not been made public, and I read them in the prosecutor's office when they were getting ready for the cover-up trial, and in the tapes in April of 1963, in conversations between Mr. Haldeman and then President Nixon, there are some fascinating conversations. Now, this is long before the taping system is even known publicly. And the president tells Bob Haldeman, says, Bob, I'm glad we've got that machine there, because he felt, and Haldeman felt, they could use it against me, the very point you made. They thought I wouldn't remember. They thought I would lie. And they'd say, well, we never trusted this fella Dean anyway, and we just happened to tape him on a few occasions. Then after Alex Butterfield did reveal the taping system, I think when he initially revealed it, they still felt they could use the tapes to their advantage, you know, releasing as they saw fit and doctored transcripts, which they did indeed try. But when Judge Sirica learned that the tapes, which had been subpoenaed by then, were not being kept well, they were keeping records of who had the tapes and who had possession of them and the like on the back of old envelopes and lunch bags and things like that, well, the judge said, I want to have a system where someone's accountable for those tapes. So it got too late. Had Mr. Nixon wanted to later have that bond on that tape burning on the South Lawn, he would have had to have had about four or five people prepared to be in contempt of court and ready to go to jail to let him do it. And I think it got too late for that.
Mm-hmm. One of the moves that really kind of made your office an important one at the beginning of your stay in the White House was your monitoring of the May Day activities in Washington, D.C. Your office became a central information center for that. And you were very young at the time, I believe, 31
mm-hmm,
at that time.
Correct.
What were your feelings about the people who you were monitoring during the May Day? Did you feel that they were really posing a moral threat?
I'd had that experience also before I went to the White House, and I assume that's why they asked me to continue it. When I'd been at the Justice Department, I'd been the person designated by the government to negotiate with all the demonstration leaders for the permits to demonstrate in Washington. What I don't think they realized, a few of them might have known about it, that I had actually participated in some demonstrations some years, or just a few years earlier before I went into the Justice Department. When I was in law school, my senior year in 65, that was just at the time that Lyndon Johnson was escalating the war dramatically and some of the first demonstrations were occurring there. I happened to have been involved in a couple of those. I empathize totally with the...
What level were you involved?
I was marching on the street. I empathized totally with those who objected to the war. I thought the war was an awful thing. But I was in a... Let me finish, if I might. So my dealings with the demonstrators, was very friendly, very cordial. We talked on the same wavelength, and I would meet with the demonstration leaders all over town. Most of the officials in government were almost frightened to go out on the street. And I'll have to tell you a little story. One time during the November or the October moratorium, I went down on the street for that night for the demonstrations, was milling amongst the crowd and talking to people involved, and came back to the office, and Dick Kleindienst, who was then Deputy Attorney General, was there. And I told Dick, I said, you ought to come out. He said, aren't you frightened to be out there? I said, no. I said, come out with me. So I took him down, and we met at Constitution Avenue and 17th Street, right across from the Washington Monument. He came down in a car with a number of policemen and marshals around him, thinking he might be pillared and stoned, and suddenly he saw it was peaceful, so he walked around the monument with me, and by the end of the walk, he said, you know, John, he said, I suspect if I were back in college today, I'd be doing the same thing. And he said, I see a lot of kids here having fun as well.
Well, that's a nice story, but, I mean, how could you initiate the activities to...
Who said I did initiate them?
Well, you were the one who volunteered your office to be information headquarters for the...
Collecting of information.
But what's the information that was being collected?
That
the
was
pictures
just...
of people who were demonstrating,
no,
what
you're
kind of
wrong.
Activities were going on.
No, that isn't the kind of information I was collecting at all.
What were you collecting?
I was collecting the facts and figures as to what was happening on the street, how many demonstrators had showed up, what the response of the Metropolitan Police would be, whether, you know, troops were being called, and I specifically kept my office out of any sort of decision-making as to what should be done and try to convince others at the White House this was a police problem and not something for the White House to get involved in.
I can't completely accept the idea of neutral conduit of information.
Well, I'll tell you, that's the way it is. It was. In fact, I have all the old memos that I wrote, which were gone over in the litigation in the May Day thing, and the lawyers involved in that case were amazed to find that we were nothing but a neutral information collector as to what was happening on the street.
Well, I suspect that one of the reasons for you writing the book Blind Ambition was to kind of counteract the image of you as squealer, you know, as person who collaborates
well,
with people.
I can't ever do that because people, a lot of people have it fixed in their minds, and I live in the land of the pariah as the snitch. And I'm not terribly interested in, and it's not important to me to change people's opinions. If, you know, you're entitled to yours and whatever, that's fine. I don't really have any objection to that. So as I say, living there in the minds of some doesn't really bother me.
You were sentenced after Watergate to 1 to 4 years, and that was cut down to time served, which is, I believe, 4 months.
4 months,
time.
Correct. No one could have been more surprised than myself that that happened, but no one could have been more delighted also, I must be honest.
I thought it was interesting. I recently spoke to Ring Lardner Jr., who has written a book about his family and his own personal remembrances of them and his own life. And he served 10 months for being one of the Hollywood Ten and not speaking before the House on American Activities. And that's just kind of a note, but that leads me to the point of serving time for something like Watergate. There are still people in prison now, like G. Gordon Liddy. His family is actively petitioning to get his release from jail. What are your opinions on that?
Well, I'm the last one in the world to pass judgment on Judge Sirica's judgments. I certainly have no basis upon which to do that. The judge was more than fair with me. The system is basically not fair, however. I must say that. I can tell you of cases I found of men in prison who had committed virtually the same offenses, and but for the fact they drew different judges, they would have had identical sentences, but they did draw different judges, and one man would have, say, 5 years more than another man, and the man with the 5 years more is a very bitter individual. I can also tell you of a case that I ran into shortly after I was released from prison, of a young person who had been arrested and convicted for possession of a little over an ounce of marijuana, and had gotten 10 years for that offense. Now, the system doesn't work when I do 4 months for what I did, and that person gets 10 years for that offense. So there are a lot of injustices in the system, and it's going to take time to get that all sorted out and have it otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as Gordon Liddy's sentence, indeed, he has a long sentence. It seemed at times that Gordon almost baited Judge Sirica. Not that that should fit into a sentence, but judges are human also.
I'd like to, if I may, play you just a short statement that was recently made in the area by Jonathan Goldstein, who is the U.S. attorney in New Jersey. And these are statements that are kind of related to what we're talking about serving time for what's called white-collar crime, and particularly about some of the Watergate sentences. I'd like to just play this short excerpt and then get your comments on it.
Everyone is concerned about street crime. It's a problem. You're not going to solve that problem until you become concerned about crime in the street, and about corruption, and about politicians and businessmen. We're basically too sympathetic to it. Lawyers argue whether lives have been destroyed. How many lives have they destroyed? And until we deal with it in a way that they're going to get significant jail terms, you're not going to deter this kind of crime, because when a businessman makes a payoff, it's a cost of doing business. And he's not worried about going to jail. When a corrupt politician takes the graft, he's not worried about going to jail. He's not worried about being exposed, because more often than not, he's not. And the only way you're going to deal with it is basically to have good investigations, but you have to have some kind of significant jail terms. Then you'll stop it. And I must tell you, I am quite concerned, because I do not think that the court's response, I think even the court's response in Watergate, has really been sufficient. The Watergate burglars were sentenced to very significant, severe terms in jail. Mr. Dean is out right now, running around selling books. Mr. Kalmbach is out. Mr. Ehrlichman is writing books, and Mr. Agnew is out. It's almost as if this kind of corruption has its own profit.
John Dean, do you have any reactions to that statement?
Well, it sounds like he's running for higher office. Other than that, he raises some very real points, though. With regard to the Watergate people, he lumps everybody seemingly in the same basket. Now, you've got to remember that Gordon Liddy did not plead guilty. I did. Mr. Kalmbach did plead guilty. I don't know why the judge released me when he did. I can only assume that he accounted for the fact that I had spent something like 16 months working with investigators and prosecutors trying to right the wrongs that I'd been a part of. So I assume he
and also,
gave me some
I mean, you
sort
weren't
of,
given immunity.
No,
and,
I wasn't.
And
I
probably could have been. I mean, it wouldn't have been a surprise if you had been in a situation like that.
Given the fact that my lawyer was very worried about my testifying with four people, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Mitchell, and a former president, was my word against theirs, and that wasn't very good odds until the tapes came out. But anyway, so there are different. I don't think you can lump them all together and treat them in a broad category of all the Watergate people being identical. Different people did different things and different offenses. The only crime I ever know I've committed was the conspiracy to obstruct justice. That's a serious crime, indeed. But I pleaded to it and took whatever the judgment of the court was. With regard to corruption the fact that you should throw the book at people as the solution, well, that's been around a long time as a suggested solution. I'm not sure that even with street crime that jail is the thing that is the solution. Prisons, if we take them as nothing but institutions for punishment and look at them in that regard, which is the light you ought to look at them in, because they don't rehabilitate anybody. When people are in there, all they're thinking about is when they can get out, and design a punishment around specifically an offense where someone knows that if they commit that offense, they're going to get X number of years, instead of all this latitude with parole boards and good behavior and all this sort of thing. That's where the system gets all confused and bogged down, plus the fact that prosecutors have the ability, as the gentleman who was just talking, to decide who he's going to charge. He has to have some witnesses. He can't charge everybody, so somebody's going to get off lighter if they, one, get immunity, two, if they plead to a one count instead of a 15-count indictment, so they'll testify for the government. So prosecutors are making judgments regularly as to the degree of punishment an individual is going to get.
Well, two things here. One is that if prison is used as a deterrent for other crimes, do you think that until it's questioned and really resolved on that issue, that it shouldn't be used for the same ways for white-collar crimes?
Well, I think that white-collar criminals have to pay the same price that other criminals do. But there are alternatives to jail where you could make very well a person involved in a white-collar crime who has some other skills often to use those skills that somehow benefit society. There are work programs that they could be put upon that would be much more productive than just putting somebody in a warehouse for 4, 8, or whatever number of years that they're punished for it, so that that individual becomes a productive element in society rather than just grows into be a vegetable and then maybe a state responsibility ultimately.
And another point that he makes is white-collar crime being its own reward in a sense, because if you serve a short prison sentence, then you can get out and write a book about it, and the book has a good chance of selling well. And I certainly don't intend anything here personally about your book.
No, I can understand that. A lot of people, and it's an issue I've been sensitive to from the outset, of trying not to abuse being somebody who's infamous and making money off of it. It first came up when I was lecturing, and I could lecture every night of the week, 5 nights a week, 52 weeks of the year. I think that would be an abuse of being somebody who's infamous to lecture that amount. With regard to my book, sure, I hope it sells. That's one of the things that people do when they spend 13, 14 months at a typewriter. You don't have time and hope to support your family if you're going to devote that kind of time to a book. So I look back in my own situation. When I got out of prison, and this would probably distress a lot of people who'd rather see anybody involved in Watergate on a bread line than in sackcloth, I had offers from big corporations that would have made me financially comfortable the rest of my life. If I wrote a bestseller every year, I couldn't touch the kind of financial security I would have had if I had taken any one of these jobs. But I didn't want to get back into what really is sort of another version of corporate politics. It's not that dissimilar from Washington politics. Wasn't interested in the rat race and decided I would try to write and make my living doing that. I don't have goals to make great amounts of money, but I do hope to provide the best income I can for my family.
You say in your book, and I think that this was at the point when you were ready to plead guilty, or perhaps it was after your sentencing, I'm not certain, but you say that you picked up a copy of Albert Speer's book, Inside the Third Reich, to just kind of get a sense of how he contended with his own feelings of guilt. And
he didn't do it in that book.
He found out.
No, I read the book. I was right after I put that in my book to show where my head was at that time. That was right after I finished my Senate Watergate testimony, and we were packing up to get out of town and to take a break from the incredible pressure we'd been under during all of that. And I threw that book in the suitcase thinking that I might find some of those answers, but they weren't there, and he somewhat deals with it, or a little bit more, in the in his later book, Spandau. But I've never really been able to subscribe to the Nuremberg-type defense, where I think every man has his own free will, and the fact that the commander gives orders doesn't mean you have to follow them. It means you're following them because you have the will to make the decision to follow or not to follow.
Well, you've served your time. You served your time.
I did indeed.
Given you, do you have any guilt feelings now? And if so, how are you coping with them? Or are they kind of resolved, having so much of yourself during the testimony, served the time that was given you?
I pretty well worked it out in my own head. You know, I'll always wear the scarlet letter of Watergate, but I certainly don't live back there, and it doesn't haunt me. I'm not pleased with what I did, but I've got to get on and start a new life. And there's a certain catharsis in writing a book where you, particularly if you do it honestly and openly, the book I've written is one my mother certainly can't enjoy because I don't come off as a very, very good son in that book. But by telling it honestly, while I can't teach or preach about it, I can certainly share for others what it was all about, because I could have never believed I'd have gotten myself in the trouble I got myself into.
What is your new life like now?
I say at the end of the book that everything is different now, and that's very true. My values are different, my aspirations are different, my whole lifestyle is different. I'm not even used to wearing suits anymore. The only reason I wear a suit now is when I have a lot of old White House suits in my closet, and if I came out in anything less than a suit, there'd be a story or a lot of seemingly it would create some stir, just the fact I was in Levi's and in a T-shirt, and rather than come out as I might be at home during a given day, any given day of the week, you'd find me, or if I were going out in Los Angeles, I'd put on the old suits, because that's what people expect, and that's so I'm coming out as they expect me.
Have your political views changed?
Well, you know, you don't know what my political views were beforehand. It's interesting, the story of my that I write in the book starts at the time I get to the White House. And I really don't deal with a lot of political issues, but I'll tell you, I've never, for example, while I was a registered Republican, had never voted a straight Republican ticket. Never thought that Republicans, or any party for that matter, could field all the candidates that could fill offices, nor did they have all their platforms have all the answers. So I've always really been rather independent in my voting, and I'm registered now as an independent, assuming that neither party would particularly want my blessing.
The only kind of reference I think that you make in your book to your political viewpoints is a kind of small reference that you were talking about Nixon's obsession with constantly referring to the Hiss case whenever he's making any kind of comparison. And you said, why is he doing this? I identify with Hiss and not with the investigators. And I was very surprised by that.
I think if you think about it, he was talking about how he had broken the Hiss case and attacked the government and the like. And I could always empathize with the Hiss side of the story. So it just seemed he had the analogy he was using in many of those conversations just backwards.
It's so hard to understand, though. If your political point of view was not really as close to the Nixon administration's as
well,
maybe,
I think a lot of the things the Nixon presidency did were good. I think, you know, we view the Nixon years right now through the lens of Watergate, and the focus is very narrow. It's down to what were the abuses, not anything good. That's all been lost. And I, you know, a lot of things. I think the China Initiative, I think detente, I think the SALT agreements were all good. I think on the domestic side, ending the draft was a very good thing. A lot of his economic policies I agree with. So there are a lot of things that have all been lost in the focus through that Watergate lens.
Do you have any still strong feelings of animosity towards him? Certainly, you had every reason to.
There were moments during the Watergate days that when I was being attacked by the White House and every effort was being made to discredit me, and they did a pretty good job. A lot of those stories still stick. That were a lot of them made up out of whole cloth, as a matter of fact. And those were rough in those days. It's still not pleasant to have the shots taken at me by many people who do, but I'm there and available for that, so they like to get off on that, and that's all right, too. But I don't feel any animosity towards Mr. Nixon today. That's really not part of my baggage I carry around. Don't feel it towards any of those people.
Mm-hmm. At the time that he was pardoned, I know you felt very strongly that he shouldn't have been, or at least you quite angry at the time.
No, it wasn't that he shouldn't be pardoned, because I can really understand Ford's rationale in not wanting to have a protracted trial that would be very divisive to the country. I can also understand why people who want retribution, and there are a lot of people in the country who want retribution, feel that they've been cheated. What surprised me was the timing that Ford did it just before the cover-up trial was going to start and caused all kinds of problems for the judge in finding a jury. He could have waited 2 weeks and the jury would have been sequestered and then done it, and that pretrial publicity problem wouldn't have existed. But even more than the timing, the fact that in granting the pardon to Nixon, that Mr. Ford did not ask for Mr. Nixon to account for himself in exchange, I was surprised that was the opportune moment.
Mm-hmm. In your book, there's a point during the cover-up where you kind of do a self-assessment on yourself. And if I can roughly quote you, you say you reflect on your talents. And
this is at that time in the story, right?
Right. This is at that time, which is right during the cover-up. And you reflect on your talents and list them as being an organized mind, ability to read the desire of superiors, and a capacity to anticipate. And then you say, quote, deep down I knew I was a meek, favor-currying staff man, not hard-boiled enough to play the games Ehrlichman and Mitchell play. How do you assess yourself now, your weak points, your strong points?
Well, as I said a minute ago, that everything is different now. And my privacy and my life today are something that it's very important to me to keep just that. I suppose that if you were to spend a week with me, you'd be very surprised at the way my life is today. But I'm not going to open myself up for the cynics to sit back and ho, ho, ho by my saying what it is. And until you have an opportunity to come spend a week and live with my wife and I, I just soon not say what it's all about. But everything is different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the studio with me is WUHY's Ralph Flood. And Ralph, I think you have a few comments or questions to make here.
Thanks, Terry. There is just one question with its ramifications and necessary preface now that I wanted to ask John Dean. You've partly covered the ground in talking about earlier political attitudes and some good things in the Nixon administration. It's in the area of politics and values. Despite what you said about some of your college day attitudes and things, as a high-level official, a high-level person in the administration of Nixon administration and council, the White House is a high-level position. You were a servant.
It's curious you say that. I was just asked a question earlier today about the Adler piece in the Atlantic, where she says that I'm really nothing much more than a staff man, another low-level staff man with a big title, and really had very little impact until Watergate. And that's very true.
Well, you're viewing yourself as a technician, but a lawyer has a right to select his clients. And what I'm saying is that as a person in the Nixon administration, you were a servant of that administration and necessarily of its ideology. Now, a number of other people who were part of the establishment in the Vietnam era, in the Johnson and Nixon administrations, have undergone fairly significant political transformations during and after their break with the establishment. I'm wondering, not just in terms of specifics, the Nixon administration did good things here, and but it was bad there and so forth, whether your political views, specifically your political views, have changed greatly. I'm thinking, for example, of Dan Ellsberg and Morton Halperin as examples who were in the establishment and now have, let's say, a liberal to radical view after having been identified with right-wing positions in administrations.
I'd say the answer to that is yes and no. Because, again, we haven't discussed all my views beforehand. And while you say you immediately identify me because of my service in the Nixon White House as being in consonance with all their views isn't necessarily true.
I didn't say that, but you made yourself a servant of them.
Well, yes, that's correct. And while I was there, it was very important to me as a young lawyer on the make to do just that. I liked that title and the potential it had and was trying to fill it. But when I said yes and no to answer your question, I've always approached, a government problem, not from an ideological standpoint, but more from a practical standpoint of how can you solve that problem. If it's more housing you need, there may be multiple ways to solve that. And what's the most practical, realistic way to do it? And I suppose if we get back to ideology, it's deciding whether you feel that more housing is needed or not. And I think if there's an area where my views have changed, it might be in discerning what the problems are as opposed to how to solve the problems.
Don't you see ideology as more important now? Don't you see that the behavior of the administration grew out of a worldview?
I think not only is recognizing the problem important, I think the solution to the problem is equally important because if you can't solve it once you recognize it, it doesn't do any good to recognize the problem and talk about it. That's one of the things that some of my friends who I guess we would call fairly left-wing intellectuals that I travel with from time to time, they sit around and debate, you know, not only the problems but the solutions, and they spend more time debating it than doing anything about it. I'm much more practical in trying to get at the problem and deal with it rather than debate it.
Your position is to get into a position of power.
No, I'm not saying you have to be in a position of power. I think everybody in there from down in the smallest suburb can do something about the problems of their suburbs if they decide they want to do something. That's much more important to me than people sitting around saying, oh, aren't the problems awful, and then debating them, but just getting out and doing them. I'm more of want to be an activist in that regard, and that can be at the lowest level or the highest level.
Well, you're not saying that all your left-wing friends don't do anything, are you?
Well, I'm saying a lot of them sit around and debate more than they do. Some of them are activists, yes, but they tend to enjoy talking about these things far more than they do doing something about them. This is just a particular group. I'm not putting this label on everybody. This particular group of friends I have.